This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Is it science or fiction? Both.
This week on Radio EcoShock, top climate science fiction writers Kim Stanley Robinson and Bruce Sterling.
No writer has written more popular novels about climate change than Kim Stanley Robinson. With tons of awards and readers, if you don't know K.S. Robinson, you should. In the 1990s, I devoured his Mars trilogy. Robinson's 2020 book, The Ministry for the Future, drew raves from Barack Obama, Bill Gates, James Cameron, Bill McKibben, almost everyone. The horrific opening, with millions dying in extreme heat, turns into a vision of how we might survive ourselves. From California, Kim Stanley Robinson, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. It's good to be with you.
Well, let's start where you began in ministry. In the future, 20 million people die in extreme heat beyond human tolerance. 60 to 70,000 Europeans died in the heat wave of 2003. Where I live in British Columbia, hundreds died in the burning heat of 2021. How did you see this coming?
I read about it in the scientific literature about 2017, and doing a little bit of history investigation, it seems to me that the finding was first published by a doctor, an epidemiologist, in 2010, pointing out that human bodies can't survive a wet bulb 35 temperature, which is a combination of heat and humidity. High heat, high humidity in combination will kill people within several hours from hyperthermia. And I think this was really somewhat known before, but the pieces of the puzzle hadn't been put together to point out that we simply can't adapt to extremely high temperatures that we're creating by, you know, releasing carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, that the so-called adaptationists of the previous decades were factually wrong. And when I discovered that, I thought, I have to write this up, even though it's going to be an ugly scene to write. It's important to tell people that this is possible, that without electricity, people will be fatally endangered by high heat and humidity that we're already seeing from moment to moment across the Earth.
Strangely, though, heat deaths often go down after a mass casualty event as people adapt. The government of India developed a heat strategy. Some folks in Vancouver bought air conditioning for the first time. But if the grid goes down, as you say, the next great heat death might not be in India. It might be in Houston or Phoenix. What do you think?
Yes, it's true. One of the hottest wet bulb temperatures ever recorded was right outside of Chicago. So the American Midwest, the American Southeast, and anywhere on the planet where it isn't dry heat but humid heat, and that, of course, is an ecological and geographical matter and extends quite far north and south of the equator, although, of course, the further north in the northern hemisphere, the further south in the southern hemisphere, the less likely it becomes. But there's a really broad zone of the habitable Earth where these temperatures are possible. And then it's a question of grid strength and social organization, preparation, knowledge of what needs to be done in an emergency like that. And then saving of lives can be differential, but if we lose electricity, then the situation immediately becomes intensely dangerous, and there's nothing to be done about that.
I blame both media and the government for underplaying the grave risk of deadly heat in a warming world. Few know that more people die of heat-related causes than in all the floods and hurricanes combined. Is heat the silent killer? It doesn't make good TV, but it is dangerous.
Yes, it tends also to first afflict the unwell, the elderly, the very young. It isn't universal when it strikes, and so far, truthfully, it has only struck for a few hours or at most a few days at a time in situations where the grid held, people had air conditioning, and indeed lots of people died. You mentioned Europe, and quite a few years earlier, 70,000 people died in the heat wave. It's happened twice, but 70,000 in a population of 300 million tends to get overlooked, even though that is 70,000 human lives that wouldn't have died without the heat event and improper preparation for it. So, yes, it does get overlooked. It's the silent killer in this situation. But since the main effect of our CO2 pollution of the atmosphere is rising heat, it really ought to be taken into account as a major factor.
And for those with scientific awareness of what climate change could really mean, there are only desperate optimists and doomers, I think, and I vacillate between the two. The dark pessimists loved the beginning of the Ministry of the Future, but were disappointed you looked for ways out. Did that surprise you?
I wonder if people were truly disappointed. Doomers are sort of like cynics. They are idealists whose dreams have been shattered and they overreact. There's a Latin American phrase, it's too late to be pessimistic. There's a certain moral necessity of holding to what Gramsci called pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will. And it's very important to remember you will that optimism. It might not be a natural result of looking at the situation, which is indeed quite dire, but you will it as a moral stance and as a commitment to the people of the future, that even though we have accidentally and irresponsibly and in some places criminally created a super dangerous situation, going forward, there won't be doom. That is a comfort. That is a solace to think, well, it'll all be over. Apocalyptic thinking is a kind of comfort food. What you really ought to say is it's going to be better or it's going to be worse. And work can be done to make it better, and worse could be quite bad. It doesn't mean extinction for the human race. It means extinction for thousands of other species, and some humans will squeak by. It could be extremely bad. I don't want to underestimate or underplay the level of badness for humanity. If billions die, that's bad enough. You don't have to say everybody will die, because that's not realistic to human ingenuity and capacity for survival. But survival isn't really what we're talking about here, unless you want to say survival of civilization. That could be lost, and that's bad enough.
The novel leads to big changes in human society, including a sort of new internet, new currency, and cooperatives, but does not explain exactly how this will all come about. And I think that is asking way too much of anyone, even you. But all that said, how do you see some of those solutions now, 4 years later?
Well, I'm seeing the rapid emergence of all of them. So I want to share a message of optimism despite the ongoing potential catastrophe. It's a kind of a strange situation to describe because on the one hand, if we push through some planetary boundaries, as Johan Rockström calls them, and crash tipping points so that we tip over into a hothouse Earth, then after that, there's very little we can do to stop those processes from proceeding. On the other hand, the rapid deployment of better methods of financing, of clean energy transition, and of social awareness. I think actually the pandemic provided a service for humanity in there, like a punch on the nose, and indeed the death of perhaps 16 million humans. But what it taught us was the biosphere can rise up and change everything quickly and kill people and disrupt lives in fundamental ways. And since the pandemic, awareness that climate change could do the same and even more irrevocably is wider spread than ever, so that the various solutions that I sketched out in Ministry for the Future, which is all reporting, they're not my invention. I took them out of the various literatures involved. All those methodologies have been proceeding apace, and the important ones, and so I'm not talking about the ownership of the internet so much as I'm talking about financing the clean transition, these are really seeing rapid development across the board. And I would say that in the 4 years since I wrote my book and the 3 years since it came out and traveling around the world, that awareness of the problem at the level of government, diplomats, business people, academics, and what you might call the general public is much heightened, and we're in more of an emergency mode than we were before the pandemic. And so I wrote the book before the pandemic. It's possible that my book is more pessimistic than it needs to be given where we are now.
Wow. Well, following the publication, you did tour internationally, as you say, not so much to promote the book, but to discuss it. Have you felt like an ambassador for a novel or for a future?
Well, for a future, I would say that I have inadvertently blown up my career as a novelist and had to regather it as some kind of public intellectual. And actually, the figure of a public intellectual is kind of a 20th century thing that's gone away. I'm uncomfortable with my new role, but I'm figuring that it's important work, that I've actually came to a hiatus in my novel writing anyway, to tell you the truth. I did not have to put off a project that was burning me through my brain to get onto the page. On the contrary, Ministry for the Future was kind of the end of a phase and time to rethink. So in that time, I've been doing climate change awareness, but also the various medications that are still possible and spreading the word as best I can.
Pinnacle capitalists like Bill Gates blogged about your book. The Financial Times reported meetings that you might have had with bankers and investors or even the military. Yet many of your books search for alternatives to capitalism. Kim, does capitalism have to go, and is there any alternative?
It's a great question, Alex, and I cope with it all the time. I would say capitalism is one name for the problem itself. It's a power relation in which the few take advantage of the many and also appropriate and devastate the biosphere of the earth for what turns out to be personal profit. It's a bad system. I'm anti-capitalist. It's the system that we're in now. So we have the nation-state system, global capitalism. Neither one is well-suited for the climate emergency, but it's what we've got, and we are short of time. I don't think it's possible to rapidly change the political economy of the world, not quickly enough to cope with this overriding problem. So that sounds bad, and it is bad. What does one do then? I think you need to look to capitalist methods that in the past have been brought to bear to cope with emergencies, such as the Depression of the 1930s and World War II itself. It was a capitalist powers that won World War II by way of the government taking over business and saying, you work for this project now. We're going to pay you for it. You're still going to make a limited profit. People are going to make a living, have jobs, but it's going to be under the direction of government. So sometimes this is called Keynesian capitalism. In any case, whatever the names are, we need to get past the neoliberal market rules all moment of 1980 to 2020 and quickly institute what might be called a kind of a throwback to Keynesian capitalism, and then push forward to some kind of post-capitalism where justice for people and sustainability and living with the biosphere, justice for the biosphere in effect, that these are encoded into the laws and into our economic practices and how we pay ourselves. Now, what that gets called is, you know, open to interpretation. I think 19th century labels are perhaps not adequate, or they misrepresent the situation, which is going to be evolving as we speak. And so, to be specific about it, the central banks of the world, those are capitalist powers, but they're run by government. So immediately government becomes an actor in this political economy that we live in. And you might say that government and finance are hand in hand, but they're arm wrestling for control. This I find a good image. And in this case, given the emergency, government has to win that arm wrestling match with finance. It's not all about maximizing profit. It's about getting into balance with the biosphere and creating justice among people. And in that collaborative contest between government and business, government and finance, government, which is to say of the people, by the people, for the people, government needs to prevail right now. So this is a political battle that I think is maybe winnable. I certainly see many humans in positions of power and responsibility who want to win it in that form of getting more control over what we do in order to save ourselves. So this is how I'm trying to frame it.
Terraforming, it's an intentional shaping of a planet to support human life. In the popular Mars trilogy, you examine those issues at a safe distance in space. Will geoengineering be attempted in a climate emergency, and what do you think about that?
Let me go back to the idea that we're in a carbon dioxide overshoot. There's too much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. We put it there. That's already geoengineering, but it was done by accident, and it's a kind of a mistake. will be heating up the planet in ways that in geological time are almost instantaneous. And it's an uncontrolled experiment. We have no idea what will happen to the Earth systems, but it's very possible that we will kick off a hothouse Earth, which is to say no ice on this planet. And no ice on this planet means sea level is 270 feet higher than it is now. Well, that is the danger. And going forward, we have to cope with that danger. If you label that geoengineering and say, oh, we shouldn't do anything so hubristic as mess with the Earth system, A, we've already messed with the Earth system. B, we may be cooking ourselves by that accidental geoengineering. And then C, we should probably try some positively inclined geoengineering to lower the temperatures. The main thing to do is to drag CO2 out of the atmosphere. That will take decades, and that should not be labeled geoengineering. That's simply doing the necessary. But in the meantime, while we're overcooked, while there is too much CO2 in the atmosphere, there are some cooling methods that are being proposed that during the decades of overshoot, we might want to do some other things to cool the planet while we get the CO2 out of the atmosphere. Those, I think, you can gather under this name geoengineering, but the methodologies being suggested are radically different from each other in terms of how planetary they are, how, in other words, are they local or are they global? Are they modular or are they systemic? Can they be reversed or are they irreversible? And each one of the methods being proposed has a different answer to those important questions. They all should be studied. And a lot of them might be employed if we could solve the governance problem of deciding how to do it and then doing it.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is famous science fiction writer Kim Stanley Robinson. My guest Jean-Marc Jancovici pointed out humans know very well how to live without fossil fuels. We lived without them almost all of our time on this planet. But, Kim, can we go back before technology?
No, there is no before technology. That's a bad framing. Humans evolved with their technologies. Technology came into play with pre-humans by way of fire and stone tools. And then we co-evolved with these technologies and became human beings. So it's never right to say before technology. There's good tech, there's clean tech, there's bad tech, there's dirty tech, there's unnecessary technologies. There are also technologies that are software systems. So law is a technology, and even language, another pre-human tech that grew and grew up. Yes, we got by without fossil fuels for the entirety of human existence until 150 years ago, say. And then we became very reliant on them. And the human population, it wasn't just fossil fuels, it was also public health and medicine, blossomed. And typically, the human population was less than a billion people. Now it's 8 billion. We need energy to make sure all humans alive have a decent existence. That can be provided by clean post-fossil fuel energy systems that use sunlight, wind power, wave power, tide power, and geothermal. In other words, we can transition to new technologies that are way cleaner and better for the biosphere than burning up the fossil carbon that was stuck underground. That being done, we can supply adequacy for the 8 billion, and it's not the total solution because there's never a total solution to our problems. But it does get to the heart of one of the worst things that we're doing, which is pumping a lot of CO2 in the atmosphere as a waste of burning fossil fuels. So we got to get off fossil fuels. We still need terawatts of energy to have decency for 8 billion people, which is kind of an astonishingly high number of humans on the planet. And yet we can provide that clean energy to that many people. And it looks like the human population itself is somewhat stabilizing and might even go down a little in the century to come, which would take a huge stress off of the system, but it isn't the most important thing. The most important thing is the clean transition.
No doubt your 22 novels have been sucked into the whirlpool that feeds artificial intelligence. Do you think AI will save this civilization or kill it?
Well, neither. We're in what Cory Doctorow calls an AI bubble. a moment of hype and intense speculation. We're in a science fiction story that we're creating, and we don't know the ending. What is AI? Well, even that's hard to answer, because the name itself is hype. It's artificial for sure, but is it intelligence, or is it extremely rapid computation? If all along it had been called extremely rapid computation, or if it had been called exceptionally powerful adding machines, nobody would be as freaked out as they are. So the name AI itself is deceptive. We write the algorithms. We have very fast computers. They can perform operations that an individual human cannot, but it was humans as a collective that invented these machines. And they can't take over. This is one of those bad science fiction stories that overlooks the questions of agency. We employ them as a tool like any other tool. And it's getting to be a powerful tool in terms of organizing information, and organizing information is really important. It is indeed one of the technological achievements of the time, and somewhat out of control. I would hope that people will put AI in perspective as sort of a science fiction story walking amongst us, and that we're telling each other collectively, and some people are using it like Frankenstein story or a horror movie or a zombie movie. The various kinds of stories that we've already told in the past, when you attempt to put it on this extremely rapid computation, usually distorts the reality of the situation and even the reality of the possibilities to come. So the one I would end this by saying, it's a powerful enough tool that you want governance for your tool. You want some rules. You want some regulations. You don't buy a chainsaw feeling worried that it might explode in your hand or leap at your throat and cut your head off. You want to have regulations that mean that that tool is safe when you use it. And AI is deserving of that kind of regulation and that kind of regard. So I don't want to dismiss it, but I don't want it to be seen as some kind of conscious agent that is aching to take over world history. That's just not true.
Some of your books are so well-researched, they're called hard science fiction. Was there some early experience that led you to write about climate?
Maybe so. As an aside, I'll say that I like being a science fiction writer, but I don't like any of the adjectives applied to it. Hard science fiction in the past was usually mostly hard in its political attitudes towards the poor. The actual science in it was just as shaky as any soft science fiction. I mean, faster than light travel being a staple of hard science fiction, that whole supposed genre is delegitimated right from the start. They're all game spaces. They're all fictional, made-up spaces. The future is unknown. So I went to Antarctica courtesy of the U.S. National Science Foundation in 1995. It was 2 months of dreamy, great, beautiful experience, both of humans and of that icy landscape down there. Two of the best months of my life. And all the scientists down there, and that's the bulk of the population down there, along with the people helping them stay alive, the scientists were all talking about climate change and what that was going to do to not Antarctica, which is a relatively, not inert, but a slow-moving giant chunk of ice, but to the rest of the world. So they were already talking climate change as being an overriding consideration, even in their own research programs. Like, what'll it do to Antarctica? But wow, what'll it do to the rest of the world? And that was 1995. And ever since then, I've been highly attuned to this. The way that our human lives and human history as a collective has been overwhelmed by what we've done to the climate. That now our coping with the problem we've created with climate change is the major driver of world history. We have to cope with that successfully, and every other human story rests under that dark cloud.
As for Ministry of the Future, one critic did not like the included love story, but what kind of future would not have love in it? And tell us about your latest love story in the Book of the Mountains.
Yes, I'm a novelist, and I needed the personal. We read novels for characters and for plot, and plot is usually the story of characters coping with something that's gone wrong. So you need that, and I had that in Mystery for the Future. There's a kind of backbone to this amorphous, weird body of the novel. It's definitely got everything plus the kitchen sink thrown into it. But Mary and Frank's story, which is a very peculiar love story, to tell you the truth, the kind of older sister, younger brother, and the younger brother's always screwing up, it's that kind of a love story, not your typical romance. That was important to me, and I think it's important to readers. I don't think Ministry for the Future would have had the same impact that it did without the characters in their plot holding it all together as something that you have a personal interest in as well as a general communal interest in. And then in terms of my subsequent work, in the pandemic and with ministry done and out in the world and kind of blowing my life apart, the pandemic allowed me to write about the Sierra Nevada of California. That definitely was a love story. It's a miscellany like ministry, but it's all about the history, geology, personalities, and a really even a memoir, which I'd never attempted before, about my backpacking life in the Sierra Nevada. Well, this is just a hobby, I have to say. I'm not really a mountain person. I'm a suburban house husband who has a hobby of going to the Sierra Nevada as much as I can. It's been great. I've loved it, but I'm not claiming that it's world-shattering or important. But it is a love story in that when I'm up there, I feel that I'm in love with a landscape. That's strange enough to be worth unpacking and thinking about and then writing about. It was a huge pleasure to do it, and I'm really glad I got that opportunity.
And I see your novel Red Mars is slated for a TV series. There has to be a film in The Ministry of the Future. Is a movie in the works, or do we have to wait, unfortunately, for real life to see that?
Well, that is one of those unanswerable questions because of Hollywood being Hollywood. Ministry is optioned by an excellent studio. They have an excellent director, excellent writer. That still doesn't mean there's going to be a TV series. It hasn't been green-lighted. There's steps to take. Until one sees it on one's screens, you can't be sure that it will get done. But progress is being made, and it's by people who I think are really good at what they do. So, I have my fingers crossed, but it's not in my power to make it happen.
Well, as we wrap up, on behalf of my listeners, I have to ask, world oceans are way hotter than ever, Greenland shedding 30 tons of ice an hour, coral in the Amazon seem doomed, the northern forests were afire last summer. Kim, do you still think humanity makes it out of this, or civilization makes it out of this alive?
Humanity makes it out alive, but that could be some kind of remnant that would be traumatized and sad, but let's not talk about human extinction. That's not really the danger. The danger is civilization. And it's so dangerous that I wouldn't want to make any assurances. We are still acting carelessly, like it isn't existential when it is. Still burning fossil fuels at a rapid clip of billions of tons per year, about 30 or 40 billion tons per year. It's too much. It needs to come down as fast as we can make it happen, and we're not doing that. So to minimize the danger would be wrong. On the other hand, as I said, in the last 3 years, I've seen that this truth, this reality, has penetrated at all levels of human society in ways that are going to matter. So maybe we're seeing a tipping point towards humanity realizing that this is an existential crisis, and maybe it will bring all humans on board to be regarding their efforts as part of the larger effort in some giant team sense. When you say things like that, people can easily look around at the world today and say, you've got to be kidding. But emergencies call forth emergency behaviors on the part of people. We see that all the time. And so if there's a recognition of a global emergency, there might be a global response. I see signs of it. So we're in a race. We're in a race between catastrophe and prosperity, and it's a quite serious race. So you can't say that what the ending's going to be at this point. It's like a dead heat. In terms of the race, and you can't give up at this point because that would be bad for the good side winning the race. And that's the only thing I can say about it right now. We're in a race, and it's a tie, and we need to work harder than ever every day to try to have the good side win.
From California, we've been speaking with American author and sci-fi icon Kim Stanley Robinson. I will post a list of his climate-oriented books and the Kim Stanley Robinson Facebook page run by his publishers in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Kim, thank you for sharing your mind with our listeners.
Thank you, Alex. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.